Hello and welcome to recording number 25 of Gary Gygax's Saga of Old City, an annotated reading. This is July 4th, 2021. I'm going to restart here. It is page 178. Gord is in Stoink and he is just done his plan and is beginning his escape with Evelé. It is page 178, paragraph number 5. Evelé was clad in a great cloak of dark gray. The hood was thrown back, showing a lining of rose-colored silk to keep the coarse wool from touching tender skin. What she wore beneath this garment, Gord could only suppose, although he noted that she was shod in soft leather boots with stout soles. Again, his eyes met hers. Break. Now, I want to jump into this right here because this is something, this is a little bit that would be in any kind of novel, as most would describe the clothing that the person was wearing. And it is something I don't see all that often when people are talking about their characters. That even if you're not, if you don't have a picture of your character, what is a nice touch is to have the players tell you the color of the clothing they're wearing. Anything that stands out, even if it's something that you can add during the adventure, about noticing something that was similar in color or just something you can add as you're going on, it adds a little depth and spice to the adventure, to mention what they might look like, what color clothing they have. It can be used in kind of things where you're going through the city and maybe you're separated, and the characters maybe see somebody and mistake it for another player character because of the coloring of the clothing or the way it is. It tends to be that I've noticed that most of the time you don't talk about clothing, you just say what armor they're in. They're in chainmail, they're in leather armor, and yet it's mostly hand-waved and generic, and not saying, well, I've got this armor and it's got this noticeable thing on it, like where it's been repaired, or leather armor where it's, got acid stains from killing some monster, or it's just every little bit of character you can add can help to flesh out the campaign. Now, this isn't something unique to Gygax trying to take the for descriptions in the campaign, but it is something that I think adds a nice touch just to remember that the characters aren't just going around in like gray cloaks or green cloaks, that part of the touch to the character background is also them either, what they are wearing, what color it is, what they do look like, whether they have brown hair, blonde hair. Even if it's only something that enriches the player's image of their own character, it adds a little depth to a game, which is mostly imagination. So rather than have them go around like colorless blobs, adding a little color and distinction is a big help to fleshing out and making the game have a little touch more depth. It doesn't have to be used often, but right on the player character sheet, they should talk about things like what they're wearing, what color it is, what clothes they have on. And that is something we do every day in our own lives. And I think that it is a nice touch to add to the game without it being cumbersome.
Yeah, I usually have pictures for my characters.
Yeah, and I like that. I also, I ran a play-by-email game. And one of the things I had was a... some game I had this like body shape image, and what I would do is if the character's got a scar or something, we'd add it to it, so that the characters could see, like, they've got like a facial scar across their chest or stomach or leg, It just was a little bit of fun, and it made their characters a little more distinctive. Now, I didn't have these modern programs I've seen which can generate character portraits, but if you can, that is a very nice thing to have. It's lovely. Early on, what I would do is I would use the cardboard stand-up things called Cardboard Heroes, and they had I'd have the characters choose which cardboard hero picture they liked, but you could do that with any kind of picture you grab, and it does add something to be able to visualize the character. And in a game, it's very nice to have that. And I've seen at some conventions where characters have like a little, like you might have a name tag, a little nameplate in front of where you sit at the convention with your character's name on it. But I've also seen it where they have like a little 8x10 picture in front, which shows what your character looks like. You know, like double-sided, one facing you and one facing outward to the other players and DM. And I've always liked that. I think it really does add something to the game.
Yeah, I have this one-page sheet, which you can fold up, and it makes a little booklet right on the front. I mean, it tracks all your stats and stuff, but on the front, there's a place for a portrait. So it's really pretty nice, I think.
Yeah, and whether you're playing Theater of the Mind mostly, or online, or at the table, you can always use that. And you know, like I was running a game here on Discord, and you can have a text channel that allows, you know, as we've shown here, using the Greyhawk Fiction, you know, you can post maps, you can post pictures, and so it's very nice to be able to have that picture, like we have our little avatars here by our names. It's very nice to have that running for a game, a picture of what your character looks like. All right, now that was just a little jump there from, but it just reminded me of that, and I wanted to mention it. It's not particular to the Gourd book here, but just the fact that he is thinking about describing what the characters look like and what they wear.
I'm going to post a picture of one of my characters, I guess.
Yes.
She's a drow.
Yeah. And, you know, that's, and like we mentioned earlier, Evelie is supposed to have that white platinum hair.
Oh, right.
And violet eyes. I just wonder now who to think on the surface-dwelling elves to show which elves have the white hair. That was really shocking to me, because if Gygax is thinking that the average person who's never seen a drow at this point sees that white hair and associates with the elvish and the violet eyes, then that really says that elves, maybe, you know, the elves in Selene, because Gourd knows this, you know, would be close to the city of Greyhawk, that he thinks that looks elvish. So that the drow are not that throwback. I had associated that white hair really with living underground. And instead, I guess Gygax just saw it as an elvish characteristic. So, all right. I'm going to restart. It's page 178. And paragraph 7. Well, soldier, are we to stand here and keep Lord Daly waiting, or are we to get on with it? This way, your ladyship, Gourd said with a slight wink. We must hurry. We are late already, he added as he pulled the door open. The guard outside the door allowed them to pass his station. After closing the door behind them, he took a couple of tentative steps along their route, as though intending to accompany them. Upon hearing the unwanted footsteps, Gourd paused and looked back over his shoulder toward the guard. Remain on duty here, sergeant, until you are properly relieved, he barked. Yes, sir, the fellow answered briskly. He gave Gourd a salute and returned to his post. Come along, your ladyship. Boss does not wait well, said Gord as he picked up speed down the stairway. Beverly's feet fairly skipped to keep up. She squeezed his arm tightly, not entirely for the purpose of keeping the pace. Where do we actually go? She asked in a conspiratorial voice. I'm really not sure of that, Gord replied candidly. There was no time for me to work out a proper plan, so as soon as I managed to find a means of freeing you from your prison room, I came ahead, figuring that luck and skill would take care of the rest. Who dared to risk my well-being on luck? It was an accusation more than a question, voiced as she released her hold on his arm. Gord took a hasty look at Evely. He was definitely not pleased with him now, as was borne out all too plainly by her expression. He replied softly, Better to have left you for sale to the plar of Rookroost. Shall we turn back then? As he voiced the second query, Gord slowed his steps. Don't be a clod. Of course we won't return, ever. Just get me out of this prison and see to my safety, Evely said with great feeling. Then she took his arm again and said, Oh, forgive me, Gord. I am frightened and alone save for you. What will become of me if we are discovered? If you are killed? I am but a weak girl and desperate for assistance. Returning to a hurried pace of descent, Gord smiled at the beautiful lady holding his arm. Evely, I will see to our escape, he said fervently, or die trying. Do not think of death, Gord, only freedom, Evely responded, regaining her resolve. In their descent, Gord and Evely got safely past the archway of the third floor where the master of the palace resided, but now that they had deviated from the path that would have taken them to Boss Daly's chambers, Gord knew he would not be able to talk himself out of any situation they might encounter on the lower floors. Gord began to move more slowly and deliberately now, looking and listening carefully for signs of activity. Suddenly, the faint sound of tramping feet coming from above caused him to stop short and turn his attention upward. The sound was getting louder by the second. It was unmistakably being made by a squad of men-at-arms in the third-floor corridor heading for this very stair. Break. We get a little show of perhaps Evely's character here. We get a little bit about that Boss Daly's chamber in the palace here is on the third floor. The biggest thing, I think, is that's the big touch of about... game design, lore, and setting. Here is just the brief description of the chamber, of where his chamber is located, and also the patrol, that there's a squad of men-at-arms patrolling the area. It brings mind to some like Flash Gordon patrols stomping their feet, or the guards in the Wizard of Oz stomping by. Or what they always did on Stargate with those troops as they stomped by in formation. But here we have, I think, you know, the key thing is more about Gord's plan is surprisingly good and prepared. I am surprised that they do not have him with a way out. It seems like he had enough time for that. And then Evely's reaction is a little surprising. I mean, I think that any modern person cringes when they have that business with that she's just a girl. I can see, especially a modern reviewer, taking a little umbrage at that. Definitely more of a thing of the times, with the girl, the clinging to the hero, is definitely something I've seen 1,000 times in pulp magazines, the old sci-fi and fantasy pulps, and not out of place, but out of, I think, current modern attitudes. And then Evely being a little haughty there, as I believe she's a baroness, is not really surprising at all, but maybe a little shocking for Gord, who's had this infatuation, love at first sight business going on. All right, I am going to restart. It is page 179, and the second paragraph to the end. Gord grabbed Evelie's arm and nearly threw her off balance as he resumed their downward flight. "Guards are coming this way," he hissed. "Hurry and be as silent as possible." Evelie made no reply, only picked up her pace to match his. She strained to land on the balls of her feet, to make her footfalls as silent as leather on stone could be. The marching sound behind continued to increase in volume. Fortunately, the pair was out of sight of anyone on the landing above, having made two full turns on this part of the stairway already. The clumping sound reached the landing and then divided into two parts. Some of the guards were moving up, but other steps were coming down the stairway in their direction. "I'll soon discover your absence," Gord whispered. "We must now hope that fortune favors us, for a hue and cry will sound in minutes." Break. That seems a little strange to me, that they'll discover that she's gone. I would suspect it's true, but I'm not really see how Gord would be aware of that. It's midnight, according to what the sergeant on duty in front of her door said. There may be something that Gygax didn't mention about Gord knowing that they checked on her at various times. But it wasn't mentioned, so I'm not sure where he's getting an idea that the patrol of guards moving up and down the stairway would be also breaking apart and one of them going to check on Evelie, unless that was like a scheduled thing.
Did he spend any time watching their patterns or anything?
No. They did not give between the time of the celebration when he first met Evelie and this business of coming and coming with a little bit of a plan. It was one of those breaks where you're not told how much time has passed between the one event and the other. But there had been mention that the due date for getting a ransom for Evelie from her father was, I guess, either passed or very closely due. And then the next thing would be the offer from the Plar of Rookroost.
Right.
To buy that. Her and an alliance. It could be that this is the next night or a few nights later. Gord has gotten his uniform as a subaltern, a tunic that shows he's a subaltern in the constabulary guards, who are the ones who guard the palace. And he knows who the commander is, and he knows that the commander was the former chief spy master, and he knows his name and who that he's in disfavor with Boss Daly. So he knows several things, but what he doesn't know is, I guess he didn't plan on the building. That's a little stumbling for me that he didn't have some plan of escape, which he says he didn't. But I don't know. I find that a little odd, and that there, just as he gets her out of there, that the guards are coming to check. Now, that could simply be that he was aware that they checked on a regular schedule, but it wasn't mentioned.
Yeah.
All right. I'm going to restart. It's page 180 and paragraph 3. Girl nodded, panting from the exertion of the rapid descent. He passed the main floor without discovery and continued down. Stairs at basement level were still illuminated by flaming cressets. so they had no difficulty seeing their way. Still, the tramping footfalls followed them, so Gord and Evelie went on to the deeper level beneath the cellar. Now the steps were damp and slippery, and only one dim flambeau shed its wavering light for them. Gord again slowed to a more careful rate of descent, fearing that if he did not, Evelie would make a misstep and tumble headlong. They had put a good bit of distance between themselves and the approaching guards, so the more cautious pace was safe enough, as far as discovery from above was concerned, at least for a short time. They passed several doors as they continued downward to a depth that surprised Gord. The foundation of the great tower must have been dug down to a depth of more than 60 feet. At last they came to a place where the steps ended, and they stood before the entrance to a large chamber. Columns and arches were dimly visible in the light of the cresset at the end of the subterranean stairway. Here was a dark expanse containing who knew what. It offered temporary shelter, however, for the pillars of this vault formed a veritable maze. Break. Well, that is an interesting bit with the stairs. I mean, Gord has entered, I thought he was on the same level with Boss Daly at first, but perhaps that was level 4. The Great Tower, in this Palace of Stoink, the palace itself has been raised up. And you'd have to believe, since Stoink has a wharf area, that it is by... that this area is either, you know, like very blocked off from the water course, and that, or else it's raised up high enough for them to go down so far. And then the other thing is, this is quite the main stairwell, because Gord has been going at it from perhaps level 4 all the way now down now to a subterranean level, below the basement level. And, you know, there weren't changes. They haven't gone off into any corridors. They're just following this one stairwell all the way down now to a subterranean level. And then that level is said to be, said to be down more than 60 feet. Mm-hmm. And then you get to a large chamber, and then the end of that stairway, there's an expanse that looks like it is the vault forming a veritable maze, the pillars of this vault. I would guess it would have to be, if it was a large open area with all that building on top of it, it would have to, you know, it makes sense that it would be, if it's not all walled in, that they'd have to have a lot of pillars holding up to make sure they didn't have a collapse or anything. All right, I'm going to restart. It's page 180, and we are on, let's see, 5, 6, paragraph 7. "Take my hand," Gord commanded as he extended his left arm toward Evelie. She did so, and then he led her cautiously into the darkness between a pair of nearby columns. There was no sound of pursuit from above, and Gord paused so that Evelie could regain her breath. "What now?" she asked. "Is there a way out?" "Other than the way we came, I know not," Gord answered, meanwhile digging under his surcoat. "Pass this rag," he said, pulling the garment off and stuffing it into a space between stones nearby. "That's better," he muttered, and he opened the pouch at his waist and drew out a tinderbox and a small candle. In a moment, he had the candle wick aflame. He instructed Evelie to remain concealed near the stairway, and he began to move slowly about the chamber. After a few minutes of careful exploring, Gord learned that the vault they were in covered more area than the tower they had just left. This sub-basement extended elsewhere under the palace itself and off at an angle that seemed to run east. Break. Now, I find it a little odd that there aren't more guards. You know, this area seemed to be pretty well guarded with patrols. And yet, here is like the conclusion of that stairway. And so obviously it is an, you know, an entrance point from whatever's in that subterranean basement up to a stair that climbs right up to the area, the level three, which has the Boss Daly's chambers and above. And so I'm really surprised that there wouldn't have been mentioned that it wouldn't have been guarded, that it would just be open to anything coming from that subterranean area. Where the rest is getting these patrols of guards and a guard in front of the door there, they're guardsmen on the roof, that there isn't a guard station set at the bottom. So I don't know if that's something Gygax will explain, that there's a reason why there's no guards down there, but it just seems to me like a little out of place. That is a very central staircase that runs right up through this tower that's the resident of that Boss Daly.
Yeah, it seems, you know, unrealistic that it goes into the... I mean, if an assassin wanted to come in, that would be the perfect way. It's unguarded if it were unguarded.
Like that there isn't like a secret entrance to this subterranean place. But at the very least, the base of the stair seems like it should have guards. But, you know, we may find out there's a reason for that. Gygax has been very good about explaining things that, you know, like I think, well, why? Ah, that's why, you know. And maybe there is an explanation down here. It is telling now here that this subterranean basement is bigger than the central tower. Now, as described, that great tower is just one of several towers and minarets that come from the Lord Mayor's Palace. And yet, the Lord Mayor's Palace is more of a fortification than like what you'd normally consider a palace. It's got a central keep, and as Gorda said, it's been built to withstand a siege. And so while it has like a ballroom, a main chamber big enough to hold 300 revelers, you know, before that celebration.
Gardens, too.
Yeah, and a garden, which obviously must be within the grounds, that Gord just leaves the celebration and goes to that park, then underneath now we have this expanse of the subterranean basement.
It's empty, right?
So far, there's nothing to it, and it's dark. There was only one cresset. It's dark. Gorda's had to take out a small candle flame, small candle, and they're using that to explore of this chamber. All right, I'm going to restart. This page 181, paragraph 3. Just as Evelise's soft cry to Gord reached his ears, he too heard the sound that caused her alarm. What had begun as a faint clamor from above was rapidly growing in volume and intensity. In a scant few seconds, as he moved to where Evelise could see him, Gord sized up the situation. It was most probable that the loss of the boss's prize captive had been discovered, and now the hunt was on. "Come here quickly," barked the young man. As soon as Evelise reached him, Gord led her into the passage that angled away from the building complex, hoping that they would find some means of egress along the route. Evelise shuddered and pressed close to him, for there were cobwebs, bugs and spiders, and rats aplenty in the dark corridor. That there was occasional traffic here seemed evident, however, by the lack of webs obstructing the center. That meant that it was unlikely that they would encounter anything really formidable inside the passage. And besides, at the moment, Gord feared no creature other than pursuing men-at-arms. The candle flickered uncertainly in the breeze caused by their movement, and its illumination was feeble at best. Despite this, they traveled several hundred feet of the passageway without mishap before being brought up short before a rusty iron door. Calling the layout of the palace, Gord guessed that they were at the base of the middle tower of the wall that formed the compound of the fortress. The door was meant to be barred on this side. The iron rod was simply leaning against the wall of the corridor. Gord tried to pull open the small portal with as much effort as he could muster, but it would not budge. It was certainly held fast by a bar on its other side. Shrugging, Gord picked up the unused rod and rammed it in place. That should prevent unwanted visitors from this end, he said, with forced cheerfulness. Now we had better backtrack and look for a door we can get through. Break. Just another little oddity. This section has a number of little oddities to it that don't quite make sense to me. For one thing, and Justin, this is a little thing, I can't remember where they had doors that barred on both sides. You know, mostly if you have a bar on a door, it's meant to keep out one side, and to have a door that is barred on both sides, that seems very unusual to me.
Yeah, it doesn't make a lot of sense. And yeah, did he see plans of the fort, of the keep?
I guess not. I mean,
well, he's able to figure out exactly or approximate where he is.
You know, he was able to. Yes, and that's yes. And did they just mention that here that he had seen plans of the keep?
Okay.
All right. Yeah, I missed that as we were talking. Yeah, as I was reading here, because Gord is envisioning where things are going, because he knows where the plans of the keep, and then doesn't seem to be, you know, familiar with how to get out of here. Yeah, I don't know. This has been pretty sensible all the way through. And I am a little surprised by that. All right. Now, where was I in this? Sorry. I am going to restart here. It's page 182, and we're on paragraph 3. Everly's grim expression melted into a thin smile for a moment as they began retracing their steps. After they had gone only a few dozen paces, they heard from ahead the clang of bare steel on stone, followed almost instantly by a great hammering at the iron door behind them. There were guards coming toward them, soldiers from the tower beyond assaulting the barred portal. They were trapped. "Lie flat on the stone beside me now," Gord said as he blew out the candle. The glow was visible ahead, light of several approaching torches and lanterns. The girl complied with his order instantly. Ben could be seen within the lights now, just entering the long passage. "What are we to do?" Everly wailed in a faint whispering voice. "Take my hand and crawl," Gord told her. "Use your elbows and knees. Keep your body down." Gord headed for the bee-webbed wall of the corridor, trying to disturb as few of the ancient cobwebs and freshly spun silken networks as possible. "It's no use. They'll find us," moaned the girl. "Hush, and don't give up yet," he reassured her. "There is plenty of chance they'll overlook us in here." Then he looked ahead and saw guardsmen thrusting their flaming brands to either side of the corridor as the knot of soldiers progressed toward them. This slowed the pace of their pursuers. The process made certain that no one would go unnoticed in the curving recesses of the arched underground tunnel. Shadows and webs, the only allies they had, would provide no obscurement for thief or damsel. It was time to come up with another strategy. "Turn around, get as close to the wall as possible, and keep up with me," Gord hissed as he suited actions to words. Left shoulder against the rough stones, he began crawling on his stomach toward the iron door. He paused for a second, and Everly ran into his feet. She had followed the soft sounds of his movement remarkably well and quickly. "Oh," she said involuntarily at the contact, as much from surprise as from pain. "Shh, I want to make certain you knew where I was. Let's move again now," he said as he resumed his worming movements. Things scuttled across his hands as he crept, and he felt a spider crawling in his hair. From the stifled gasps and faint rustling noises coming from behind him, Gordon knew the girl was experiencing the same unwanted intrusions. Suddenly, surprisingly, there was no stone against his shoulder. Gord almost entirely overlooked the opening in his desire to escape the oncoming men, then realized the message that his nerves were transmitting to his brain. He stopped abruptly after his upper body had passed the place, and again Evelyn hit his feet with her head and uttered a soft sound as before. "Back up about 2 feet quickly," Gord whispered sharply. Gord could not make use of the light from the torches and lanterns of the men-at-arms searching the passageway, for they were, fortunately, all things considered, more than 100 feet distant yet. So he used his hands to explore the perimeter of the opening, and they told him it was a rectangle about a span high, and perhaps a little more than half again as wide. It seemed to slope slightly downward, as near as he could tell by reaching into it as far as he could. It was low and narrow at the entrance here. About a foot beyond it seemed to open up into a rounded pipe, probably a drain for this place. He knew that his size and skills would enable him to negotiate the passage easily, and Lady Evelyn was fortunately also slight and slender, although Gord suspected that her bosom and rounded posterior might pose some problem. "What have you found?" asked Evelyn, a hint of panic in her voice. "This is our way out, my lady. It is a small hole that leads to a safe place. I'll crawl through first. You come as close upon my heels as possible, but be cautious of my kicking feet when I turn and enter. As soon as my legs are through the opening, follow me with all speed."
I suspect that he's just kind of giving a positive twist here to Evelyn, because he doesn't seem to have ever been aware that there was such an opening. So saying it leads to a safe place is, I think, just words to calm down Evelyn. But again, I just find it very odd that here Gord runs into a trapped way. That here this long, very long passage, as it turns out, because these guards are still 100 feet down at the other way, and Gord's been moving, on his belly against the wall, trying to remain hidden, that he suddenly discovers this low opening, and that is a bit of a, that's a such a chancy thing that he didn't know that he'd be able to escape this way. I'm just a little surprised that it is being stated this way. I would have been more interested that he was knew. I just think it would have made more sense at this point if he knew that this opening was here and it was searching for it, rather than suddenly here's their means of escape when, that looks like all is lost.
All right, it is, I'm going to restart. It's page 183, and it is the final paragraph. Without waiting for a reply, Gord turned his body and wiggled his way through the opening. In just a couple of seconds, he was clear of the rectangular opening and into the somewhat more spacious pipe beyond. He crept ahead farther to make room for Evelyn. Breathing indicated she was laboring to get through the small access hole. Then, just as he was hoping it would not happen, "I'm stuck," she cried. "Help me, Gord." Break. Less here for commentary then. This is the end of paragraph 18. they're, you know, I don't think this last bit really, there's anything here to mention, but we are beginning here at chapter 19, page 185. So I'm going to just jump into that, restart here. Chapter 19, page 185, paragraph 1. Searching guards could be no more than 50 feet from the place now. Within a very short time, light from a torch or lantern would reveal the form of the would-be escapee, even though the webs above and around Evely were very thick. Ward wished there was room for him to turn round, but he knew the cylinder was barely wide enough for forward progress. Drawing up your legs and pushing with your boots, Gord called over his shoulder to her, as loudly as he dared. Push your forearms tight against the walls to anchor them, and hunch your body ahead wiggle-wise, he added. Then he moved ahead a bit to see if there was any place that might afford him space to reverse himself and lend a hand. A big bug of some sort plopped on the back of his neck just then, and Gord reacted with an involuntary sweep of his hand to remove the vermin before it bit him. His hand did its work, and he was surprised to notice that it did not make contact with any surface above his head. In a flash, Gord rolled over, and with his back to the floor reached upward. There was a square vertical shaft here. It allowed him to rise, cautiously erect. Once upright, he turned, lowered himself until he was again on his stomach, and now found himself in a position to crawl back toward Evely. "Oh," said Evely, startled at first contact with his hand. Before she could utter anything else, Gord grabbed her by the upper arms and yanked her toward him. He worked backward down the pipe a short distance, enough to straighten out his arms and pull her toward him again. She was well clear of the constricting entrance now, and able to move on her own, so Gord merely backed a bit further, stood up once again in the shaft he had discovered, and quickly climbed upward a couple of feet. "Gord, where are you?" Evely whispered into the darkness. "Just ahead. I'm in a shaft that goes up. When you hear me clearly, use your hand to find the opening above your head," he instructed the frightened girl. "I'll keep talking, and I'll climb up farther so you'll be able to stand in here too. Are you at the place yet?" Gord heard her moving directly beneath him. "Yes, I'm going to stand up now," she said. "But I can't climb." "I'll help, so don't worry. We're as good as free now." Actually, Gord had no idea where the shaft would lead, or if they would ever escape. But here was a chance. This was no time for doubts. So Gord, again, doesn't have any idea, really, and his words that there was safety ahead were just to make Evely feel a little better. It just seems a little more coincidental, or that they find their escape route by luck rather than planning by Gord. And I personally would have expected something more, that Gord had noticed something about an air vent or a tunnel, or and had come to the bottom looking for it, rather than in a moment of desperation they just happen to discover exactly what they need to find. So I am a little surprised, because I think the story plotting has been a little more solid than that, and this one just seems to be a little more finding this escape tunnel at the very last moment seems, you know, just a little out of place to me. All right. I'm going to restart right here. It's page 186 and paragraph 6. There was a good foothold just a couple of feet up into the shaft, and using this advantage, the young man braced himself and reached down between his feet to where he felt Evely's hands grasping at his booted legs in a desperate attempt to move upward in the chimney. As the sounds of the search in the corridor outside grew even louder and closer, her small hand found his groping one. The little fingers closed on it with surprising strength, grip of terror. He called and she came upward, feet scrabbling noisily on the sides of the shaft as she did so. I hear something in there, a shouted voice echoed through the pipe and up the shaft. Look, there's been something crawling around this damn drain. So they had found the exit way quickly, thought Gord, but could they get through the opening as easily as he had? That was the key to the question now, for they needed time to get up this chimney and to wherever it led. Shouts and commands that followed indicated that armor was being stripped off for an attempt at entry. Some guard tossed his torch into the narrow passage that neatly rolled all the way to the opening in which Gord and Evelie were hiding. It was time to move upward as swiftly as possible, while the noise and confusion of the intending pursuit passed their ascent. Break. I'm not getting a clear picture here, because I thought that the tunnel slanted down, went to a round pipe, and Gord was moving past that when he reached up and found there was an opening above him. And yet, now that they've tossed the torch down, it ends up just below the opening, kind of saying that, and that seems like the tunnel sloping down ended just where it started going up, and that was not my original impression. All right. I'm going to restart. It is page 187, paragraph 2. Holding Evelie in place with one arm, Gord groped upward with the other, seeking a crack in which he could lodge his fingers to pull himself up farther. Then his spirit leapt as his exploring digits closed around the cold metal of an iron rung. Grasping it firmly, he used his other arm and his feet to help his frightened companion upward at the same time. Fortunately, the hard soles of Evelie's boots made it possible for her feet to find purchase on the sides of the chimney, so Gord did not have to bear all her weight in addition to his own. And after this bit of practice, she became fairly good at hoisting herself up. The pair clambered up until Gord's waist was opposite the rung set into the stones of the wall, and the top of Evelie's head was even with his shoulders. Thanks to the faint illumination afforded by the torch, Gord discovered another metal rung about 2 feet above the first one, in what seemed to be the start of a ladder arrangement that would enable them to ascend more easily. Sounds from beneath them were louder now. Someone was in the passage. But no sooner had fear begun to rise in his throat than Gord heard a deep voice cry out, "I'm stuck! Push!" Gord allowed himself a slight smile as he grasped the second rung and boosted himself up another few inches. As he did this, his shoulder pushed against a projection on the wall opposite the rungs. The projection pivoted smoothly upward. Under the pressure he had accidentally applied, at the same time a dull grinding sound came from beneath. In a moment, the light from the torch below was shut off. "What happened?" the girl inquired. "I think my shoulder tripped something that closed the mouth of this shaft," Gord answered excitedly. "This must be a secret means of escape placed here by some bygone lord, and long forgotten, no doubt, else the passage would have been shut tight, and we would now be worming our way hopelessly towards some deep sink or cistern." Gord felt the beautiful girl shudder at the thought. Just turning a page here. At the thought of what fate could have been theirs, he helped her move up until her feet were braced against the lowest of the metal rungs. Then he felt his way a few feet farther upward, confirming to himself that the metal bars did indeed progress up the chimney, that they were strong enough and anchored well enough to hold under his weight. The thoughtfulness of the builder in making them thick was appreciated by Gord, although he was sure that time and decay had weakened them sufficiently to bring breakage from hard or heavy usage. Neither he nor Everly would be so careless as to unduly strain these metal rungs. Break. Again, this is Gord, by luck, discovering this secret passageway. And it also, then I was right in the impression then that the circular passageway was going downward and was continuing, which Gord foresaw might end in some kind of cistern, below the earth to, let out any extra liquid or drainage from that subterranean passageway. I may be mistaken, but it seems strange that the torch thrown in would land in the slanted tube just under the open passageway, unless there was some kind of leveling underneath. But again, that's just, not mentioned. So this particular part of the story, there's a great deal of luck or some other means that is occurring. There's, it seems strange. There's no plan of escape. They travel down this basement and then follow a passageway to a dead end and shut door. And the Gord has the sense then to bar it. But it's locked, that's locked from both sides. And then they discover a sewer drain that has a hidden passage that is luckily enough to be open at that end. I just, bit by bit, this just seems a bit haphazard and, with no plan, they're doing all this stuff. So I don't know where this goes, but it might end up where there's an explanation. But I find this a little, this bit here a little strange. All right, let's see. I'm going to restart here. It is page 188, and it is paragraph 2. Positioned just above the girl, he pulled out the candle stub once again, sparked the tinder, and got the wick alight. Sure enough, more rungs led upward, reaching into the darkness beyond the area illuminated by the tiny candle flame. "I'll ascend slowly, one rung at a time," he told Everly. "You climb just behind me, being careful not to place all of your weight on any one rung, and holding firm so as not to slip or fall. You understand?" "Yes, I can do it easily here. This is just like a ladder," Everly sounded slightly hysterical, but she climbed calmly enough. She also climbed quickly so that Gord was forced to stop looking back to watch out for her, and instead devote his attention to keeping a good pace ahead of her. The shaft led them up no more than another 30 feet, then it opened into a cylindrical cell about 20 feet in diameter, a vertical passage coming out about 3 feet from the base of the wall. The center of the cell's domed ceiling was about 8 feet above Gord's head. There was nothing in the place except a tangled heap of old, filthy rags lying a short distance from the shaft opening, and an ancient lantern a few feet away to the other side. The ladder still held the remains of a thick candle. This Gord set to burning, the small taper he held, extinguishing it as the larger one came to life. "How do we get out of this place?" asked Everly uneasily, as she gazed at the unbroken expanse of stone that formed the walls of the cell. "No place such as this would exist," Gord told her in reply, "unless the builder had made some means of exit. Its purpose is secret escape. Therefore, we must look for a hidden means of egress, unless the entrance is secret too. The rest would not be, lady, Cord explained. Oh, said the girl, brushing dirty hands against Smudge's cheek. But how do we find a secret means of leaving this tiny place? The air here is bad. I can hardly breathe. And the walls seem to enclose and suffocate me. Help me look for marks on the floor or wall, which could mean stone moving on stone, Gord said as he put down the lantern near the center of the chamber. Don't worry, it won't take long, for I'm skilled in this sort of thing, being a thief. Gord, too, noticed that the air within the room was stuffy and stale. It was damp and reeking as well. He suspected that their breathing and the flaming candle helped to make it worse. So there was more than one reason for them to hurry. They might still be pursued from below, if there was a way to open the chimney from the other side. And certainly they had to get out of this chamber before the bad air overcame them. Both of those facts seemed almost immaterial to Gord at the moment, however, for something else was creeping over him. Gord's spine crawled. An insufferable sense of foreboding seemed to weigh upon his whole being, almost as if the cell were indeed contracting, closing in to crush and entomb them both. What was wrong? There was a faint stirring behind him. Gord spun cat-like, his hand going instantly to his dagger. There was a little puff of dust just above the pile of rags. Some air blown just then. Beverly was already busy inspecting their prison, working the area of the chamber farthest from the pile of rags. She seemed oblivious to any incipient menace. Gord scolded himself silently, shrugged, and set about to join her in the search. His imagination was getting the better of his common sense, and that was no way to get out, he told himself. Still, no harm in keeping his dagger at the ready. I will work on the opposite side over here, he said. Take your time, lady. Better to be certain than miss the clue we must find. Beverly, who was bent over, scrupulously examining every inch of the floor and wall in her vicinity, only muttered a distracted agreement. Gord turned and went toward the curving stone across from her. He started to kick the bundle of mildewed cloth near the base of the wall. Somehow he was unable to bring his booted foot into contact with such unwholesome material. The heap actually had a man-like form, Gord noted as he gazed down at it. Too long, too thin, but man-like nonetheless. And even as he stared in horrible fascinations, rags silently twitched and twisted themselves into an even closer semblance of humanity, and from the heap an odor of mold and putrescent flesh wafted its way into Gord's nostrils. Gord took a step back with an involuntary gasp of fear and disgust. Stuff was trying to form itself. Whatever it was, it meant them no good, and they were trapped with it. Fortunately, Evelie was engrossed in her search. She had not looked in Gord's direction for some time, and apparently the stench that rose from the rags was not potent enough to reach her attention. I think I feel something, she called, keeping her back to Gord as she spoke, and running her hand along an area low on the wall she was examining. Good work, my lady, Gord replied with a shudder, as the rag thing flopped wetly in its efforts to raise its upper half. I'll join you in just a moment. Now the man-shaped clump of rotting fiber was in a position similar to that of a person seated on the ground, arm-like appendages propping its headless torso upright, legs drawing toward the body so as enable it to arise to a fully erect stance, and a thick, wormy thing was slowly arising from within that horrible torso, a thing of sickly gray with yellow pulsing veins visible through its membranous skin. this worm creature was the head of the rag, body, Gord knew what to do. Without hesitation, he stepped forward and swung the keen dagger in an arc. A moldy twist of rags flew upward as an arm would to block a blow. The razor-edged blade cut through the filthy cloth and struck the worm just below the bulbous upper protrusion that must have been its head. Reeking matter splattered the nearby wall and ran down it in viscous gray-yellow strands. The severed bulb fell noiselessly onto the rags and left a foul stain on the fabric and stone it touched as it rolled a few feet and disappeared down the shaft. A sigh seemed to issue from the heap of rags, an almost human sound, and the whole pile collapsed back into formlessness, making a disgusting, squishy sound as it did so. And here we have a picture, a Clyde Caldwell, like everything in the book, of the ragworm monster that Gord had attacked. It doesn't quite, I think, meet the description that's going through from Gord, but still very nice. Now, we've reached the end of the day. It's 7:01. I'm going to leave off here. It is page 191. What do you think here of this this section that we've gone through?
It's a little confusing. I think I probably want to reread it and try to maybe map some of it.
Definitely. I found it very confusing, and I also found it very implausible. I don't know, because Gygax pulls things out and reveals after, you know, like I'm thinking of something and, you know, like I said, I'm asking, why is this happening? And then we get to a page or two later and it explains why it's happening.
Yeah, it's happened a number of times already.
Yeah, but all of this sounds so strange that there are no guards on the stairway, that there are... You know, it just seems strange about this whole thing, and that the bottom passage, it has this open drainage area. Maybe they don't check it very often, but it just seems very strange that is a potential, escape or entrance with an open passage going down somewhere. And that they discover it by chance, and then they discover the secret passage, and the torch lands just under it, and yet we're told that the passageway is sloping downward, and it continues on to an unguessed depth where Gord thinks there may be some kind of cistern at the bottom of it, which kind of reminds me of that area in the Steading of the Hill Giant Chief in the basement, where there is a passageway that leads through a troglodyte caves and then to an underground cistern and stream that leads out of, that flows down below the steading. And here we have this right here. Now, the other thing that I wanted to note about this Daly seems a little like Theobald. And this seems like a little bit about the escape from the beggar's mansion. It has similarities to me that this escape, in a sense, seems very similar to what he wrote at the beginning with the escape. And, it's not one for one or anything. And I'm assuming that this quick little decapitation of the ragworm here goes unnoticed by Evelie to make it humorous. I'm not sure, but I think in the next passage that she's not going to notice that Gord has just the rising monster that seems like it's quickly been dispatched here. I don't recall such a creature in being described anywhere else.
Yeah, neither do I. It's unique to this book, I think.
Yeah, and it's not a bad monster, something I would say something that generates from a corpse, perhaps, rather than just moldy clothes. Maybe there has to be some kind of corpse involved with it. But, you know, it seems to be inhabiting that ragged clothes, or it could be some kind of magical, you know, creation where that if the clothes are disturbed or something is tripped, that it has two forms. One is this slimy worm, and the other is a moldering pile of cloth. You know, so it could be a little surprise creature right here.
Yeah, I mean, there's other creatures, I guess, that are like it, you know, that appear to be something else.
Yes. Yeah,
but
I mean,
not it explicitly.
Yeah, and this seems to defy from a ragged pile. It's growing in size, you know, so it seems to be gaining substance that isn't naturally there from the start. You know, it's not like it's coiled tightly and rises. It seems to be, but of course I'm looking at this Clyde Caldwell, which shows what seems to be a very large creature, you know. It's maybe that Gygax meant it to be much smaller. It certainly dispatched quickly, but a decapitation shot can kill, you know, even a powerful creature. Well, I'm going to finish up for tonight. It's 4th of July. We're finishing on, here I jumped ahead, page number 191. So here we're well past halfway, but it is really as far as the book goes. Now, as far as our commentary recordings, can't really say, well, were they going to see another 25 or another 30 or another 20. It's depends entirely on the content of the story, and some sections we're going to comment on a lot more. There was a lot of action right here. So I'm going to close off for today. I'm summoning up Craig here. My keyboard has worn off my letters on a lot of these keys, so just doing it from memory.